we are in an extended portion where I think in the next few weeks we do need to do an entire chapter. And today we are in Esther chapter 3, and the theme is a little bit different. For those of you who've been coming to church a lot, you're probably not used to a theme like this. For those of you who haven't, we're glad you're here. But the theme today is hatred. And that's not something we usually talk about. You know, usually we want to talk about love, about kindness, about compassion. Chapter 3 is all about hatred. You know, Haman's introduced into the story, and we see that that what characterizes Haman is this intense hatred for Mordecai, which then becomes a hatred for the Jews. And that really drives the story for the rest of the book. Now, hatred, I don't have to say this too often, but hatred's a very powerful emotion. It's overwhelming. It affects our decision-making. It affects a lot of different things in our lives. It starts maybe as something small, and then it explodes. It blossoms. And it's a very difficult thing to deal with. The funny thing is, in a lot of ways, I think, not just we as Christians, but I think for a lot of us, we tend to think of a spectrum of emotion, and typically love is at the very top of the spectrum, and hate is at the very bottom. We tend to think that love and hate are really opposite emotions, and they're really not. They're actually very, very similar in a lot of ways. Matter of fact, I think for a lot of us, we want to believe that we are incapable of doing hateful, evil things, but we are just as capable of doing evil things as we are doing loving things. They're very, very similar emotions. Matter of fact, what the Bible kind of shows us and what life shows us, if you pay attention to it, is the opposite of love is not hate. The opposite of love is indifference. I mean, that's when you know that you really don't like someone, is indifference. Love and hate are actually very, very closely related, and they're both very, very powerful in that way. And we'll see how they're connected. But the scary thing is that the hatred we see here in Haman is it's a hatred that we're capable of, every single one of us. We may not have the position to do what Haman did. We might not have the ability to decree the things that he decreed or to use our hatred in these mass ways. But every single one of us has the capacity to hate as much as we have the capacity to love. And just in saying that, our hatred is not always sinful. I mean, the Bible tells us that there are things that we should hate. You know, we should hate evil. We should hate injustice. We should hate wrong things that are done. Unfortunately, for most of us, we don't live in that world, though. For most of us, our hatred is very, very sinful. Even when it has tinges of righteousness to it, it turns into sin very, very quickly, doesn't it? So what we're going to be talking about today is, I think when we get into to Esther 3, what's really unique is when we look at Haman, when we see the way that this hatred begins to play out, Esther 3 essentially gives us what I would call an anatomy of hatred. And I think it's very, very interesting for us to be able to look at. Essentially, when we break it down, in Esther chapter 3, we begin to see the cause of hatred, at least sinful hatred. You know, again, we're talking about the sinful side, not the righteous side, but we see the cause of hatred. We see the curse of hatred, and hopefully we also see the cure of hatred. I don't know if you've walked in here and there is hatred in your heart for a particular person or things going on in your life, but again, every single one of us is capable of it. Just as we see Haman rail against Mordecai and the Jews, every single one of us has a capacity to be wicked, to be evil, to sinfully harbor and to live out a hatred in our lives. And I think we need to see what this looks like. So that's what we're going to look at: the cause of hatred, curse of hatred, and ultimately the cure for hatred in our lives. So first, the cause of hatred. If you go into the first couple verses of it, we're going to walk through a couple of the verses here, but essentially we get this introduction. It says, after these things in verse 1, King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes as we historically know him, promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set him above all the officials who were with him. So this is in the wake of the plot that's happened. There's some shakeups and some changes within the king's court, and Haman, this man, is exalted to a very unique position where he's above others. And the question that we want to ask as we start reading and start looking at Haman is this question of, well, where does this hatred come from? And we do see the genesis of it. What causes it, specifically for Haman, more generally for us? So we see Haman come onto the stage. And again, just to go backwards, you know, we've met Xerxes, we've met Vashti. Xerxes cast Vashti out, and he initiates this beauty pageant, and through that, Esther is brought into the kingdom. She becomes queen. She sits on the throne, and then there's this plot. So all the major players have been introduced to us: Esther, the king, Mordecai, except for Haman. So chapter 3, Haman comes on the scene. And we don't know that much about him, but the way he's introduced tells us something. If you notice, the description that we're given here is that we're given his genealogy. In Mordecai's introduction, we see his genealogy, and his genealogy is very specific. The author tells us his genealogy in order to tell us that Mordecai is a spiritual man. Now, we find out with Mordecai that he is a true Jew. A true lineage, it goes all the way back to Benjamin. He's a true Jew, and the author's trying to tell us he's a spiritual man. The same author, when he introduces Haman, says this. He says, gives us a background. He says he promoted Haman the Agagite. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with other parts of the Old Testament, but that's a very familiar name. Haman the Agagite tells us that he's related to and connected to King Agag. King Agag shows up in the book of 1 Samuel. And if you remember, there's a very important instance in the book of Samuel where the first king has been anointed. Saul is the leader of God's people, the first king. God gives him a command to go into battle against the Agagites, and when he goes, to destroy everything, to destroy the people, to destroy all the animals, and to not take anything, to destroy absolutely everything. And if you remember in the story, Saul goes out, he wins the battle, and when he comes back, he brings the king, and he brings cattle and livestock. And if you remember, he's in camp, and they're celebrating and whooping it up, and the prophet comes, and he says, "Why have you disobeyed the Lord?" And Saul says, "What are you talking about? I went into battle, won the war." He says, "Then why do I hear this bleeding of sheep? Why is the king still alive?" You know, what we're immediately being told from the beginning is Haman, right from his genealogy, we're told this person who's just showed up on the scene is going to be an enemy of God's people. And that's the history. Now, Haman, I don't know if Haman knows the history. I don't know if he really cares about it too much. It seems like it's not a complete driver in him wanting to destroy the Jews. But the introduction is given so that we know immediately from the start that here's someone who's going to be an enemy to God's people. So we see that, and it's very clear. We have Haman, who is a nobleman, but in this story, he is going to be an enemy. Haman rises to prominence, and we don't really know why or how. And then we find out in verse 2 that there's a problem. If you go to verse 2, it says, "And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage." Now, if you notice, that's the crux of the problem. The problem is that the king has commanded that all of his servants should treat Haman this way, that he should bow when he comes by, and Mordecai refuses to do it. You know, it's a command, it's customary. And we have no idea why. You know, we have no idea why Mordecai makes this decision. What we do know, I guess you can say we know a little bit. What we do know is there's some spiritual reason behind it. We just don't know what the spiritual reason is. Some scholars have said that there was some personal conflict and that somehow, you know, Mordecai's Jewishness conflicted personally with Haman, and so Mordecai realized he couldn't respect him. There's other scholars who say that Haman was a pagan follower, and so he had probably some pagan symbol on his clothing, and so when he would come up, Mordecai refused to bow before him and bow before the pagan symbolism on his clothing. But we really don't know. What we do know is this is what causes the problem. Now, the problem is that Mordecai is supposed to do, Mordecai is supposed to bow before Haman, and he refuses to. And the way that I can tell you that it is a deep spiritual problem, it's not just a personal problem, but it's a deep spiritual problem because Haman, Mordecai risks a lot to do that. You know, the king is commanded for all of his servants, all of the people who work for him, all the people who serve him to do this. So it's not just a personal issue. It's not just a personal vendetta. It's not just Mordecai saying, I don't like that guy. Something serious is going on because Mordecai literally is risking his life. The king has commanded this. And if this makes its way back to the king, he could be in deep trouble, and yet he's willing to do it. So something is going on. It's very serious. It's spiritual in its roots. And it's the thing that causes deep resentment. What we see is that the problem kind of grows and grows and grows. And if you read verse 5, we see how far it goes. It says, when Haman saw, when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. All right, so we see the genesis of all this. We see the fact that it goes from this thing that starts to happen and it becomes serious. As a matter of fact, in verse 6, we find out how serious. It says, but he, this is Haman, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, so what did he do? So as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. Now think about this for a second. How angry do you have to be to want to kill everyone who's a Jew? I mean, that's pretty angry. I mean, that's a lot of hate. You know, I've hated people in my life. There have been people that have hurt me or people that haven't hurt me that I've just hated. And I've never gotten to the point of, I want their whole family dead. You know, that's a whole nother thing. And yet, here is Haman. He's so enraged. He's so infuriated that he wants to see every Jew exterminated. I mean, that's a whole nother level. It's this terrible thing. And why? Well, it's funny, if you think about it, there's a lot of people that could be in the exact same situation that Haman's in that could just brush it off, right? I mean, you could imagine another official where Mordecai doesn't bow to him and he could say, okay, fine. If you want to be that way, that's fine. You know, it doesn't matter to me. Right? Have you ever noticed that? Like, we have different sensibilities. There are times where people do things to us and it's not a big deal. Someone can do the same thing to someone else, and it's a big deal, right? I mean, we have different sensibilities. Why is that? Well, what's actually happening is this. You know, what we know from Haman and what we can tell about him through this story is that it seems to be that Haman had built his entire life around one thing. It's not what you think it is either. I think you read the story, and a lot of times people think it's power. You know, he's rising up the ranks, and he wants power. He's grabbing it wherever he can, and he's looking to be, you know, this great and powerful. It seems like when you read through the story carefully, it seems like he's built his life on one thing, and that one thing is respect. That's what it seems like. It seems like all his efforts for power, all his efforts for money, all of that is this desire to be respected. And you know what's interesting about respect? Is if you're in a room with if respect drives you, if you're in a room with 100 people and 99 of them respect you, one of them doesn't, guess what you notice? You notice the one that doesn't. And it burns in you. I mean, 99 can look up to you and bow before you and say, wow, you're so great. But the one person, if respect drives you, the 99 can say wonderful things, but it's the one that you remember. That's what you remember. And you know, what we see here in Haman is that's what he lives for. And the Bible tells us what that is. The Bible says that that's an idol, right? Anytime you set something up as the supreme objective, as the thing that will make you happy, as the thing that will bring meaning and purpose to your life, as the thing that will make everything else better, if that one thing is not God, then it is the wrong thing. And that's exactly what Haman's done. He's built his life on this one thing, respect. And you know what will drive hatred in your life? What will drive pure, undiluted hatred in your heart is when someone gets in the way of that one thing that you've set up. And that's exactly what Mordecai does. Haman lives his life to be respected. His quest for money, his quest for power is all driven by it. And Haman refuses to give it. You know, why does that matter to us? There's a lot of people who do things that hurt us and we don't hate them. But hatred in our lives comes when people stand in the way of the things we cherish, the things that we chase after, and those are always things that are not God. Matter of fact, for some of you, your most intense hatred is directed at God. Why? Well, because in your heart you've said, this is what I need. And it seems like in your own experience, it seems like God's the one who's getting in the way. You said, you know what I need in life is I need this. And if I could just have this, that would make everything make sense. Then my life would be meaningful. Then things would be wonderful. And in your experience of it, it seems like you can never get it. And in your desire to attribute blame, it falls on God. Well, guess what happens? What happens when your life is directed at something besides God and you seem to be thwarted at every turn? Then God is the one you begin to curse, right? That's exactly what happens. You know, we are capable of intense hatred. You know, we're capable of it when people get in our way. You know, I haven't worked that much in the workplace, but I've seen it there. I've seen where someone wants to climb the ladder, someone gets in the way of that, a boss, a coworker, and there's hatred. And sometimes it's very veiled, it doesn't come out through normal circumstances. Other times, it's not veiled at all. It pushes its way out in every situation, every circumstance. You know, that's where hatred is born. It's born when we want something that is not God, and God or other people get in the way of that. And when that happens, it can take over your life. But that's really where hatred starts. Hatred starts because someone gets in the way of something, and the thing that you want, even though it's not God, you really believe it is. And so when those people step in, when they get in the way, when those things are hindered, it really draws from you hate. That's actually one of the great diagnostic tool to use. You know, if you look in your life, you look at the people that now or before you've been really angry at, more angry than you could ever believe, you know, inordinate anger, moving into hatred. A lot of times if you pull that apart, you begin to realize that in some ways you really weren't following God, that in some ways you were chasing after something else, and that's really what was driving that type of hatred. Another good application, another good way to deal with that is, like I said, for some of us, maybe not now, but for some of you at different points in your life, you've been angry at God. And that comes from a very simple place. It comes from the fact that for whatever reason, there was something else besides God that was vastly more important. And God seemed to be the one getting in the way, knocking that down or pushing you over for that. I think those are great diagnostic tools to realize, what am I living for? Why is that so important to me? But hatred always flares up, you know, when we're trying to chase this other thing and something keeps us from it. Very, very helpful in some ways. Second thing we see is the curse of hatred. And hatred does have a curse. You know, I could say very simply that what hatred does is it wreaks havoc on us. It ultimately ends up crippling our own souls. If you go into verse 7, these are details that a lot of times when I've read the book of Esther, I haven't really paid attention to. But if you go into verse 7, I want you to notice the timestamp that we're given here. Verse 7 starts out in the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast lots before Haman day after day, and they cast it month after month till the 12th month. You know, so their calendar is different names, but it's about the same. It's 12 months long. Haman has harbored this grudge, this anger, this hatred for a full year. You know, verse 7 starts in January, ends in December. Now, he's doing something in those 12 months. We read it and we have no idea. You know, it says that they're casting these casting lots. What's happening is this. Haman has spent a full year devising his plan. And now what he's doing is this idea of casting lots. what he's done is he's meeting with fortune tellers, with diviners, and he's basically asking them through casting of these lots, when is the best time for me to actually initiate this plan? And that's actually what happens right after that. It says 12th month, and then he initiates this plan. So imagine the hatred that's involved in this. You know, here Haman sits and he plans it all out. I mean, I can imagine him laying in his bed like, you know, just kind of thinking through the details of like, you know, what it's going to be like and what he should do and how things are going to work. And once it's planned out, he starts going to fortune tellers saying, tell me the exact best time to start this. And he waits a full year. I mean, there's a lot of hatred in order to do this. I mean, there's a lot of forethought. There's a lot of malice that's going behind it. Everything is planned. Everything is worked out to the T. And then he goes to the king. And if you notice, even in his interaction with the king, we see the plan unfold. What he does is he first tells the truth, then he tells the half-truth, then he tells the full lie, right? If you go into verse 8, here's what he says. It says, then Haman said to the king, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. That's true. The laws are different from those of every other people. That's kind of half-true, right? I mean, they follow God's law. And then here comes the full lie. Very end, he says, they do not keep the king's law, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. Even in the way he presents this entire picture, he's worked everything out. For those of you who've ever had to tell an extended lie, which is probably all of us, you learn at a very early age that the best way to lie is not to simply lie. The best way to lie is you tell the truth, the half-truth, and then the no-truth. That's the best way to lie. And that's not my encouragement to you to show you how you should go about doing it, but that's the most effective, right? If you say something that's true, partially true, and then not true, it's very believable. If you just come out and say something that's a full-blown lie, most people go, what are you talking about? But if you walk them down this path, say something is true, half-true, then full lie, they go, that sounds right. And you pull them in. I mean, that's exactly what he does. That's, as a matter of fact, if you go back to Genesis 3, that's exactly what we see Satan do. You know, it isn't the lie that gets them, it's the truth that gets them. And through the truth comes the half-truth and then the no-truth. And that's exactly what Haman does. Haman knows exactly what he's doing, and he does it beautifully. Matter of fact, he's so committed to this that we find out towards the end in verse 9 that he's even willing to put up his own money. He says, I have 10,000 talents I'm willing to put out so that the message goes out, people are able to do this, you know, and it's amazing. You know, 10,000 talents of silver is 75 pounds of silver. Now, I know some of you here have more jewelry than other people. No one has 75 pounds, right? I mean, I'm assuming I can't go into your bedroom and open your closets and find, you know, unless some of you guys have a lot of bling that you wear around your neck. No one has 75 pounds. You know, that's what he's offering. That's how committed he is to this. I mean, he is ready to go. He has put everything in motion. And for us, we see how insidious this is. He isn't just trying to destroy Mordecai. He's trying to destroy Mordecai by destroying all the Jews. I mean, that's genocide. Now, this is no laughing matter. This is no small thing. This is hatred to the nth degree. And, you know, he manipulates the king. He abuses his position, his influence. And we see the result. The result is the king lets him launch this legal decree that it is okay to kill Jewish people on this particular day and to take all their possessions. That must have been the weird, if you notice at the very end of the story too, at the very end of the chapter, it says all of Susa was thrown into confusion. I mean, how many times does something like that become a law? You know? 3 months from now, on this day, you can kill people with brown hair, you know, or on this day, you can kill people with freckles. You know, it's strange for us. It was strange for them, too. You know, this wasn't a normal occurrence for them. You know, so we find out at the very end, after all this has been done, the message goes out, everyone goes, what? What's this new decree? What are we supposed to do? And it's a strange, strange thing. But it's, again, it's born of this hatred. And what I want you to notice is this. I want you to notice that in all the planning and all the timing and everything that's happened, this hatred that resides in Haman's heart has absolutely consumed him to the point where nothing else matters. Have you ever felt hatred like that? No, a hatred where it becomes so deep and so intense that it feels like you're starting to wear blinders, where all of a sudden everything that that person says or does is evil. You know, there's someone that you hate and they might not know it. You see them in the way and say, hey, good to see you. How are you doing? Oh, this is what they mean. You know, they really know and they're trying to push my butt. There they go again. That's what's happening. He is so completely consumed by it that it fills his heart, it fills his life, and that's all he can think of. You know, that's the sad thing about hatred. Hatred has this incredible capacity to take over, to take control. And you know why that is? I mean, obviously it's because we're sinful, but there's a good reason for it. Love and hate are very closely connected, and the way God has designed is God has designed love in such a way, he's designed us in such a way that love is able to completely take us over. That's a wonderful thing. That's a great thing. You know, you stand before the cross and you realize what Jesus has done, and there's times where it just takes you over, where it melts your heart and it moves you beyond belief, and you feel like that's all that is inside of you. Well, hatred can do the same thing. Hatred can reach in. It can twist the controls of your heart, and pretty soon it consumes you. And you know, it's a terrible thing to be consumed like that. You know, all of a sudden you stop seeing the good in things, you stop, you know, you don't find yourself enjoying life anymore, and it spills into every area of your life. Have you ever noticed that? What hatred does is it affects everything. If there's someone that you intensely hate, you know, you see them from a distance and one of your friends goes up to talk to them and seems to have a really good comment, you go, I hate them too, right? I mean, it consumes you. It takes over. You go to bed and you think about that person and it consumes you. You find you toss and turn. You can't sleep. You know, you're on edge. I mean, what hatred does is it completely takes over. It spills over. And more what happens is you begin to neglect your responsibilities. You begin to neglect relationships. You know, in your desire to hate, you begin to push people out in very subtle ways because that's what you're thinking about. And it's incredibly corrosive. It sucks the life and it sucks the joy out of daily living. And you know, the funny thing is, if we're not actively expressing it towards others, it doesn't affect them at all, does it? I mean, they might not know that we hate them and they're just do going about and you see them doing that and that makes you hate them even more. But you know, like, it doesn't affect them. It's not like they're going around like, oh my gosh, they hate me, I'm scared of them. Sometimes they don't even know. It is so incredibly corrosive and destructive. And the thing that it typically destroys first is us. It overwhelms us. I mean, there's ways that happens even on a small scale, doesn't it? I mean, there's little things that happen in marriage or with friendships, and those little things start to get a little bigger and bigger. And because they're not talked about, because they're not brought out, they begin to corrode, they begin to destroy. And hopefully in those relationships and those friendships and those marriages, something happens to turn the tide and it gets fixed. But, I mean, we've all felt that. We've all felt those little things start to corrode. We've all felt those little things start to take over. Because that's the power, that's the curse of what hatred does. The curse that it has is it affects us. And it begins to destroy us from the inside out. You know, and the hatred always backfires. It drains your life away, and it ends up consuming you. So, that's the whole sermon. I hope you have a good week. We can't end there. We have to talk about this fact that there has to be a cure for hatred. What all of us know is hatred is difficult to deal with. It doesn't just disappear. For instance, like you could have this serious problem going on in your marriage with a friend, with someone, you know, whatever the situation is, and if other people see it and come up to you and say, "Yeah, you really have to let that go," it's hard, right? I mean, other people say it and it seems so easy, but it's hard. Hatred doesn't just disappear. It doesn't just, you know, disintegrate and you go, "Okay, I feel so much better now." You know, you can't just tell yourself, I'm being stupid about this, or I'm just going to forgive them. It doesn't go away. You know, that's actually one of the difficult things about hatred is when it gets to that point, it doesn't just disappear. I will tell you this, and I think this is important for us to understand. What has to happen is actually the hatred has to be swallowed. And this is what I mean. You know, there's times where people do things to hurt us and we become angry, we become bitter. And then they come up to us and they say, I'm sorry I did that, will you forgive me? And a lot of times on an initial reaction, we say, of course I forgive you. But you know, a lot of times when that happens, we still haven't dealt with hate. We haven't really swallowed the hatred yet. And the reason why I can say that is because, I mean, when we do that, someone comes and says, oh, I'm sorry I did that, can you forgive me? What happens the next time they do something that's kind of like that? Hatred rears its ugly head again, right? And you begin to realize that you haven't really dealt with it before. You know, what all of us know is dealing with hatred, with anger, is actually very painful. If you genuinely forgive someone, it's painful. You know, it's when someone asks you to forgive them and you genuinely forgive them, what you kind of understand is you have to take all the hurt, all the pain, all of the responsibility, all the experience of that, and you have to take it on yourself. Because honestly, they might feel bad a little bit, but you know, in order to forgive someone, you're the one who has to bear the brunt of all the pain and all the difficulty. In other words, you have to swallow that. It doesn't work if you just kind of mouth and say, yeah, we're okay. You have to actually know and tell yourself, I'm the one who's going to take, you know, this pain. And a lot of times when you genuinely forgive someone, again, there's little things that spark it again, but you go, no, I'm taking it. And it's a difficult process. It's not just ignoring pain. It's not just pushing it aside. I mean, you have to swallow it. You have to take it deep into your soul. And only when you take it in, when you accept it, when you receive it, can you then begin to genuinely forgive where you're not going to live out of that anymore. But when you go to forgive someone, you know that has to happen. You know, in hatred, you want them to carry the pain. You want them to hurt. You want them to feel the pain of doing that. You want them to experience the difficulty of that. When they ask you to forgive, you know that they're not going to, and that you're making a decision that you will, right? I mean, we all understand that. True forgiveness means that we are going to be the ones who ultimately take the pain of the hatred, and that we're making the decision to do that. You know, again, even if they feel bad, we know that in forgiving them, they're really not going to feel all of it. And you know, that works as long as we're willing to do that. You know, in this passage, in this particular chapter, we actually don't see the cure for hatred. Haman lives out this hatred to the nth degree. We see this plan continue on, and eventually it leads to Haman's hatred ends up swallowing him. If you remember, he builds the gallows, and he kind of rubs his hands together. He says, ha-ha, you know, Mordecai's going to swing on these gallows for everyone to see that he is the evil human being that he really is. And by the end of the story, Haman's the one strung up. The story doesn't finish out in a way that tells us what the cure is, but you know what? There is a cure for our hatred. And I will tell you very honestly that only if you're a Christian do you actually have the genuine resources to deal with hatred in a way that will be transforming. In other words, I think the cure for hatred comes in the Gospels. It comes later on. It comes in Jesus. If you remember, when you look at the life of Jesus, the death of Jesus and the resurrection of Jesus, that his life, death, and resurrection is the core of our faith. When you look at Jesus at the end of his life, you know, all the leaders gather together and they hatch this plan, and it's a devious plan. You know, they're going to take his teaching and twist it against him. They're going to say that Jesus is teaching this terrible thing, that it's against Roman law, that it's against Jewish law, that he's blaspheming, that he's doing these terrible things against the Roman Empire. And that's going to be their justification for stringing him up. The end of Jesus' life, I mean, there is an intense hatred that is pointed at him by the religious leaders. And what's shocking, too, is when Jesus is tried and convicted, and then when he is beaten and flogged and marched through the crowds, a lot of the same people who were out there waving palms saying, you know, this is the king who has finally come, hallelujah, they're the same ones who then turn that love into hatred. And they mock him, they jeer at him, they spit on him, they despise him. And in their hatred, those who even were glad to see him come are now glad to see him strung up. And if you remember, there's this really unique moment on the cross where Jesus looks out. Few disciples, his mother's there and John. But Jesus looks out and all he sees is he sees hatred. People who want him dead. Do you remember what Jesus says at that point? He says, Father, forgive them. They do not know what they do. In that moment, what Jesus is doing is he is swallowing their hatred. And you know, at the very core of our faith, the thing that makes us Christians, the thing that makes us who we are and what we are, here we have the Son of God swallowing the hatred that he sees all around him, so that he is thus able to forgive. He's willing to take the pain, the anguish, the difficulty, and he's willing to take it into his own soul in order to be able to forgive. Let me tell you, there's something else that's going on. The other thing that's going on is on the cross, Jesus takes our hatred. And you could say, how is he doing that? Well, again, Jesus cosmically is taking our hatred, because for you and I, we have another hatred. Our hatred isn't just towards other people when they hurt us or other people when they stand in our way. Our biggest hatred is towards God. The Bible tells us that we are sinners, and what that means is it means that we are people who naturally want to live our whole lives in rebellion, in hatred of God. That we don't want God ruling our lives. We don't want God running our lives. We want to push God out at every turn in every way. And what the Bible tells us is that we are evil. We hate God from morning to the end of day. In every way, in every fashion. And on the cross, what we see is Jesus even takes that hatred. And we see it when God looks at him, when Jesus looks up at the Father, and he sees nothing, he feels nothing. What he's experiencing in that moment is the hatred, the wrath of God that you and I deserve. Now, why is all that important? Here's why it's important. I told you before that the only way you can cure the hatred in your heart, if it's a relationship in your life, if it's someone that is, you have to swallow, in your forgiving, you have to swallow that hatred. You have to swallow that pain. Do you know what? You're never going to do it. Well, actually, you might. The only way you'll do it is if you have a friendship that's close enough, that's been long enough where they've done it for you, you've done it for them, right? Where there's kind of a give and take to that. You'll swallow the pain if you know that they're willing to do that for you, right? If it's not, then you say, it's not worth it. Why should I put myself on a limb? Why should I be the one to make the sacrifice? Why should I do this if I don't know that they're going to do it for me? Why should I do that? Well, sometimes you're willing to do that because your friend swallows pain for you sometimes. But it's reciprocated. You know, as a Christian, here's where you could find tons of reasons to say, I'm not willing to swallow the pain. How do I know that they're going to do it for me? You don't. But as a Christian, here's what you do know. You know that on the cross, Jesus swallowed your pain. And so, for you and I can then do that for others because it's already been done for us. You see how that works? It's no longer about whether your friend will be willing to swallow pain for you when there's a reciprocation. Something has already been done to you, and now you can reciprocate. And it's not going to be towards Christ, it's going to be towards other people, but you can do it because Christ has done it for you. And only when you understand that Christ has done it for you will you ever be willing to do it for anyone else. If you don't understand that Jesus has done it for you, you will refuse at every turn because it's not worth it. Why should I put myself out there? Why should I do this when it puts me in danger? Why should I do it if I don't know my friend is going to do that for me? But if you're a Christian, you can say, you know what, I'm going to because it has already been done to me. And like I said, when you really believe that, when you believe that your hatred has been swallowed up at the cross, then you can swallow up anyone else's hatred. And that's the only cure for it. You can't simply push the hurt aside. You can't simply push the hatred down. You have to know that your hatred was taken away. Only then can you take others away. You know, if you're here today and you're not a Christian, every single one of your relationships is give and take. And you will only give as much as you've been given to, or you will only give as much as you think the other person will give to you. But that means that you will never truly experience love. It's only when you realize that God has taken away your hatred can you then begin to truly love him and love other people. And you know, honestly, I think that's one of the best reasons to become a Christian. Because God has taken all of this anger that's in your heart, and on the cross he has swallowed it all. And because he has swallowed it, I can now love, I can now forgive, I can now give myself both to him and to other people. Let's pray together.